Hey folks, this is Ben and Jordan, and we are back for part three, our third and final part of this discussion on the intersection of soccer slash football and politics. Episode one, we chatted about, Austin FC, the perspective of an Austinite, a Texan American on soccer, and some of the ills of American style of sports on international soccer via the Super League and other such things.
48 fabulous hours of the European Super League.
Yes, and then part two, we had the chance to talk about, a kind of list of incidents where, football and politics and conflicts sort of intersected around the world in other countries in Europe and South America and Asia. And finally, we're going to close the series out or the trilogy out with a few more incidences, in South America and Europe and Africa. And then we're finally going to end up on a discussion, a pretty important contemporary discussion that's been kind of hashed out a lot, but bears mentioning, of the 2022 World Cup being held very absurdly in Qatar.
Exactly. Absurdly, we'll get into that. That'll be fun. But first, I would like to talk about Wayne Rooney, who's been recently named as the new head coach of Derby County FC, who competes in the championship level of British football. British, by that I mean English, specifically English football. Don't get mad at me if you're in the UK and you're not. Yeah. Anyway, so the reason I want to talk about that for the next 2 hours before we get to our other subjects is that their logo is a pretty cool drawing of a ram, a drawing of a ram.
It is pretty sick. I'm looking at it
Yeah.
now.
It's like, this is the first episode I talked about Sheffield Wednesday and their cool ass owl crest. Because a lot of English football team crests are just very, proper looking and like the crust of Sutterfield or whatever, and then this is just like, oh, this is a cool ass ram, way cooler honestly than the LA Rams ram. So best of luck to Wayne Rooney on his cool ass ram team.
We support the guy. He had a stint in
Wayne Rooney, there's Rooney.
very,
Anyway,
very good
playing
player.
FIFA, I always remember hearing that. It's like, and there's Wayne, now Wayne Rooney.
Yes, FIFA, very good soccer game, as we mentioned last time, but not a good international sport
Association.
organization. Yeah,
Yeah,
pretty
no.
whack.
Yeah.
But we have a lot to say about that. But before we get into that, let's go to a very long country in South
Long
America.
chili. This is regular chili. You've seen the long chili memes. This is regular chili, but it
Yeah.
is still quite long.
Yeah, Chile.
From Patagonia in the south to the Atacama Deserts of the north.
Oh, yes. And fun little note before we get into that. Jordan and I realized that we're both fans to an extent of vexillology, the study of flags. And a very fun thing you see a lot in Texas is, dumb frat guys or people to that extent using the Chilean flag emoji as a Texas flag emoji because they're very similar.
Yeah, just posting it when they're drunk at Whataburger at 3 in the morning. Like, bro, put the Texas emoji.
There's not a Texas emoji, unfortunately, because then we'd have to do one for every U.S. state, and that gets kind of indiscernible at
Yeah,
emoji
there's some
level.
really bad state flags. That's sort of coming for a vexology episode that we will do in the
Yes. Yeah,
future.
we'll have a whole big thing about
Yeah.
that. There's a wealth of history about communist vexillology and the vexillology of U.S. state and city flags. Anyhow, Chile, they have a national soccer team, and they've had a few conflicts, internal conflicts. What's going on there?
All right, so no discussion about Chile is complete without talking about what the United States CIA government specifically did to that country in the 1970s. After following the election, the Democratic, fully this like everything chill election of socialist President Salvador Allende. Allende, I just pronounce his name two different ways because I'm a dumbass American. Allende. He started instituting major reforms in the country right away, trying to uplift the poor, doing cool left-wing stuff. Was loved by, the working classes in the country. And that was very, very quickly crushed by the Nixon administration. Kissinger, working with the police and army, were still, intact in Chile, especially the army. And so the United States basically funded a military dictatorship that essentially killed the Yende and like began quickly, a systematic campaign of repression against leftists. There's the infamous current fascists today, Proud Boy types love to celebrate the whole helicopter thing where they were to drop, suspected communists out of helicopters to their death. People were rounded up just for having, like left-wing literature in their homes. And many of them were taken to the National Stadium in Santiago. Many of them were taken there and imprisoned there. It became essentially a prison camp. People were tortured, interrogated, just like punished for the sin of not being a fascist. And all this was done with the direct support of the United States and the capitalist, ruling class, international community, like you name it. This was, very much there's no concern about, we're always talking about human rights, abuses when we want to invade somebody. But when it comes to, a country that we need human rights abuses in order to take out someone who's marginally bad for business, so to speak, in corporate geopolitical terms, there's no problem. And of course, we talked about Israel in the last episode and what's happening in Gaza, Saudi Arabia and Yemen, we've mentioned, all of that being done, with direct US material support. And this was no different. But anyway, the National Stadium was also used by the Chilean national football team, who had, finished fourth in the CONMEBOL region, South America region of World Cup qualifying, which meant they could play in a playoff against the Soviet Union, who had finished in the correct place in Europe to join the playoff, and the winner would advance to the World Cup. Now, they were set to play a two-leg match where they would play one match in Moscow, one in Santiago, and then they would total, it's called a
Aggregate.
aggregate. That's right. Aggregate, bro.
American
It's
moment.
called the
Sorry.
aggregate. There's a this came at a, this came at an awkward time because, obviously Allende is a leftist, being overthrown by a United States-backed military coup by the fascist military general Pinochet. Soviet Union did not look kindly on this, as this was part of the great, chess game of the Cold War, so to speak, where the United States was doing everything it could to stomp out, communists and socialist influence around the world by any means necessary.
Real and otherwise.
Real and yeah, and imagined, and or even in Allende's case, who he's essentially like he's not, I don't know,
Allende wasn't necessarily committed to building world communism.
yeah.
He wanted to do some left-wing
He wanted
reforms
to
to
help
make
his
things a little
country
better.
and like improve things in a country where things have been terrible. Like there's a lot of income inequality, like still dealing in a post-colonial kind of world. So it was decided by the military dictatorship to go ahead, send the team to Moscow for the qualifier, for the playoff qualifier, in order to, save face and make things look like they were going swimmingly in Chile, or at least normal somewhat, when most of the world was becoming aware that things were very not great. And they go to Moscow. The reception is chilly, of course, because the Soviet Union is pretty pissed about what's just happened. And when they show up to the stadium to play, there's boos, and it's the players are kind of seen as the face of the country in the situation. But apparently the reception improved after the match when they drew 0-0. It was a competitive match, no one won, but there's two legs, so no big deal there, as long as the second leg gets played. And so essentially they return to Chile, and the team, Soviets, knowing the situation in the National Stadium and knowing it's being used as a prison camp, demand to move the match to a neighboring country such as Peru or somewhere else. Chile obviously would be very embarrassing for Pinochet for this to happen. It would be an admission of the crimes being committed. So, and this is again where FIFA shows up. Like, there's a theme here. FIFA, shows up along with the Chilean Football Federation and members, 100 members of the military government, to tour the stadium. And they've at this point taken all the detainees, prisoners, and put them, in like the back recesses of the stadium, held at gunpoint, to where they can't say anything. And the stadium tour just consist of FIFA and the other officials walking around the middle of the field and being like, oh, this looks good, wink, wink.
Yeah.
And so it was a pretty, like, you know, another kind of chapter of FIFA where you start to see that there's, like, a lot of ethical underpinnings to the organization that are not so great. So given that they're then Soviets are given an ultimatum, they have to come to play at the National Stadium. The Soviets refuse and forfeit. Normally on forfeit, you don't play the match, right? It's done. It's over.
Right.
Like, Chile is going to the World Cup. But keeping up with, you know, the show, they decide and they get FIFA to agree to require Chile to take the field and score a goal to win the match against nobody.
Yeah.
So they do that. There's, you know, video of this. Like, they just take the field in an empty stadium. Actually, no, there are people there. People in the stadium, everything. So you're wondering where the prisoners. They, in the week between, you know, the days before the match, they were shipped off to the Atacama Desert, mm-hmm. which is known as, you know, a very inhospitable place.
Yeah.
So they just move them out of sight, out of mind, and play this, like, completely farcical, quote-unquote, match where, you know, the Chilean side just, you know, passes the ball around for about a minute, and it kicks it into an empty goal, and that's it, and Chile is going to the World Cup.
Just absurd.
Yeah, just very much just shows the absurd, you know, when you get this sort of, like, tyrannical fascist government, and there still needs to be this pageantry, there needs to be this, like, this sort of, like, false, like, display of, like, things are normal and this is good and this is how things should be.
Right.
The players, you know, absolutely, you know, it had to be embarrassing for them to use those props, being used in a cover-up of the abuse at the stadium. The players would go to practice at the stadium and see dead bodies in the streets and see the military roaming around and arresting anyone whose political views or maybe their ethnicity or whatever didn't fit with what Franco, you know, intended for Chile to be. And, you know, it was just a messy situation.
Yeah, so, just awful. Yeah. And, I mean, that's, you know, to be expected of a fascist dictator for sure. But, you know, FIFA, it's wild to see basically this, you know, supposedly neutral, supposedly objective, just focused on football organization really kind of get in it with, you know, awful, awful regimes for the sake of, you know, just keeping things running, keeping things, the money flowing. In South America, another interesting, you know, little moment in world conflict, kind of, in international geopolitics, was the football played between Argentina and England shortly after the Falkland Islands War. For those who don't know, because it's not necessarily taught super well in American schools, especially about the Falklands War, but there's these islands off the coast of Argentina, the Falkland Islands, as the British know them, or the Malvinas, as the Argentinians know them. And there was a whole big thing in the 80s with Margaret Thatcher and Argentina, where they fought a little war over who gets to keep the islands. And the islands to this day are still British, despite being thousands upon thousands of miles away from the UK.
It's not exactly the Bahamas either, I'd say.
Yeah.
It's very, like, cold, like, subarctic kind of climate. Not frozen, but just always, like, cold. Like,
yeah, just a shitty place to live.
Yeah, like, cloudy, just no trees, though, because it's not quite warm enough for that. Like,
right. Just a barren, windy, salty little place.
What is this, Miami Beach? Not hardly. It's like a...
Yeah.
It's a, just had a brief memory of the film Groundhog Day.
I've never been to the Falkland Islands, so if any Falklanders want to, you know, prove me wrong or whatever. Yeah.
Prove me wrong, Falklanders.
Yeah.
Some guy just, like, emails me. He's like, how dare you talk shit on Port Stanley? It's the Paris of the South Atlantic.
Yeah, I'm sure. But yeah, seriously, if there is anybody actually listening from the Falkland Islands, do please let us know, because that's really interesting. Yeah. I'm sure we'll put, like, have a Twitter at some point.
Tweet us, DM us from the Falklands.
Please do, yes.
We'll be going on the road there.
Yeah, we'll make a tour stop in Falkland Islands.
Both the West Falklands and the East Falklands will have multiple shows.
Oh, yeah.
Tickets now, folks.
But interestingly, Argentina and England played a match at the World Cup in 1986.
They did. Nothing memorable happened.
Yes.
Just kidding. No, it was actually one of the most like one of the matches of all time. And but prior to that, Argentina had also, like Chile, had to deal with a rightist military coup, junta, if you will, that ran the country from 1976 to 1983.
Yes.
And this was during, like, you know, the development of its, I mean, like I said, the golden years of Argentine football, and like Diego Maradona, you know, one of the greatest players who's ever played. He, you know, starred for the team and everything else, and you know, this happened in the immediate aftermath, you know, also the Falkland War, and so what happened is FIFA, you know, despite the military dictatorship, you know, despite everything else that happened in 1978, still agreed to hold the World Cup there. And, you know, it was, you know, not a good place at the time. There was, like, a lot of repression. And so another case, just like Chile, where, you know, FIFA was like, oh, that's fine. It's cool.
Yeah.
Do your thing. Buy those shoes. So a lot has been happening in Argentina. And so when the 1986 World Cup rolls around, there's another thing to get into to talk about before we talk about the 1986 World Cup. And that is Ozzy Arbeláez and Ricardo Villa, who were Argentine football stars, who became the first South American players to play in the English Premier League. Mm-hmm. And the English Premier League at the time was predominantly, you know, made up of players from the British Isles. It was, you know, seen as, you know, the ultimate development of English football players for the national team. And it was controversial at the time to bring over players from another continent to play there. And especially because they're playing for Tottenham, you know, a high visibility club in Northwest London, a team that has a lot of history. But you know, they really wanted these players because they were so, you know, they knew they were good, and like it was a game changer. It was a big game changer for the English Premier League to have South American players, mm-hmm. who, you know, brought that a different style again, because England, you know, had its way of playing football. South America has its way of playing football, and you know, they were able to blend, like, you know, that more the beautiful game of South America with you know, with the precise, like, you know, like, orderly British game, and ended up doing very well, you know, winning the FA Cup and things like that with them there. However, when the Falkland War breaks out, they're playing in England.
Yeah.
Argentina invades the Falklands, which had been occupied, you know, since the British Empire, and like, it becomes a very awkward situation for them because the country, you know, they're from is at war with the country where they live.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Ozzy ended up, you know, leaving England for a while and just training the national team because he just couldn't handle, like, the stress of that and constantly being asked about the war, being seen as, like, you know, being looked at differently in England, whereas also being seen perhaps as a traitor in Argentina, because this was, you know, there was a lot of tension between Argentina and England about this. Like, that there were, you know, hundreds of deaths in the war.
Yeah.
And the Falklands aren't even very populated. There's only a few thousand people living there.
Right. Definitely a shitty situation for those guys.
So, you know, they had another subplot of that is having to deal with that, as well as, you know, all the tensions that existed, the military junta, which was really hard in the country. So finally, the junta's over, Falkland War has been settled, with England is the winner, and the 1986 World Cup happens in Mexico. England, Argentina in the semifinals. Argentina, like, wins in a way that is just, you want to get revenge. There's, you know, there are different ways to get revenge. You can, mm-hmm. you can beat the crap out of a team, or you can win in a way that is just so thoroughly just debasing, but may not look so on the score, but, you know, the way this happened. So the first half, you have the infamous hand of God goal, where, you know, a ball comes off Diego Maradona's arm. It's ruled not to be a handball by the ref, and they end up scoring a play on the play, take a 1-0 lead.
Yes. Funny enough, in that when that goal happened, it was pretty obviously to, like, the cameras and the spectators and the players a handball, even to the extent that the Argentine players didn't celebrate at first. But after, you know, Maradona scored the goal, you know, basically put the ball in the goal with his hand, which, you know, at this point you probably know you can't do in soccer. None of his teammates were celebrating, so he was like, "Hey, come celebrate with me before they disallow it."
Some corny guy who calls everything sports balls, like, this isn't hand egg.
And then after the match, in like an interview, he said, the quote was, "The goal was scored, quote, a little with his head and a little with the hand of God."
A little from column A and a little from column B.
So that was how they took the lead.
But that wouldn't be the winning goal because it was a 2-1 match. The winning goal ends up being what is widely regarded to be the goal of the century, the greatest goal of all time. And then, given this entire geopolitical context and the thirst for revenge that existed against England, in many ways, Diego Maradona dribbles through, or in the second half, dribbles through five players, five defenders, getting England one of the best teams in the world, one of the favorites to win the World Cup. Maradona just skates through them and then scores just a ridiculous goal, and putting Argentina up 2-0, they would go on to win 2-1. That would be the winning goal. So you have the combination of like a very debatable but very supernatural kind of goal, in the hand of God goal, and then you have just the goal of the century. And England goes down 2-1, and it's sort of like the you could argue that this is one of the most cathartic sporting events in history, partly because of, the rivalry that existed on the pitch, but partly because there was so much at stake in terms of like just bad feelings between the two countries.
And that kind of thing happens a lot with you see kind of broader geopolitical conflicts like play out on the football field, which in some ways is a welcome change to like war and violence, but often it precedes or follows those things.
And I would like to talk about Maradona a little bit more too, because he fits into the broader thesis of this like little series we're doing. Like he either had or developed later in life some pretty like good left-wing politics. He's hung out. He visited Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and was close with him and admired him. He had Evo Morales in Bolivia before the coup that knocked him out of power, that was led by the United States very recently. Maradona only passed away recently, like, rest in power. So, and so he only passed away recently and, well, left a huge legacy, of being like a very, very human person, because, he had his things he struggled with. He struggled with a cocaine addiction all of his life. The sort of like, part the lifestyle he lived probably contributed perhaps to his early death, but also, he was a very like aspirational figure for a lot of people, and really seemed to care about like humanity enough to like attend anti Iraq war protests in person, and then like and speak out on these subjects when he could have just he could have just fucked off to like the Caribbean or something, and just lived in luxury. But instead, as a superstar, he like devoted the later years of his life to trying to influence, at least in his own way, making the world a better place.
Yeah, it's very easy as like a wealthy person or like a sports star to just kind of, when somebody asks you about politics, be like, "Oh, I'm just a soccer player."
And it seems, despite the like intertangling of politics and the sport, that a lot of soccer players have historically, due to being in precarious situations, maybe like based from where they're from, where they're playing, like if you're playing in Franco, Spain for Real Madrid, like it's there's only so much you could say to keep your status and in where you are. And like you said, like, it's not something where, until maybe more recently with the campaigns against racism and things like that, that you've seen players get more outspoken. But traditionally, it was, definitely seen as a stick to sports kind of thing, I think, for a lot, traditionally for a lot of players.
Definitely. Also, I've just recently read that apparently Maradona had a portrait of Castro tattooed on his left leg and of Che Guevara tattooed on his right arm. Pretty based, if you ask me.
Base Diego.
Yes, he's definitely the secretary of the base department. In talking about football and politics and you know, some of the things that Maradona spoke out against, like colonialism. One of the places where we see sort of colonialism rear its head in the football sporting world is Africa. Africa is a massive continent, has, you know, dozens of countries on it, all with, you know, very diverse people and cultures and politics. But basically all of Africa shares the fact that they were colonized by European powers largely. During the scramble for Africa and then through, you know, into the 20th century, and then even still to this day through neocolonialism and the legacies of de jure colonialism, they still are very, very much experiencing, if nothing else, de facto colonialism. And you kind of see that in football, in the sense that Africa just does not get the funds or the attention or the care and investment or basically any of the resources needed to thrive and kind of, you know, be the superstars that the European countries are.
Yeah, it's true too in so many respects. And like, you know, the key thing to remember about Africa is while it, you know, it's a continent that is often, you know, sort of dismissed as just being like, oh, it's a country. People think of it as a country when it is like so many different countries, so many different regions and like cultures. And from Northern Africa, which is, you know, like very Arab influenced and like, you know, had a lot of history of Bedouin culture, sub-Saharan Africa and like, you know, South Africa, Eastern Africa, they're all very different, you know, regions. But like in terms of colonialism, they're united. And in terms of like, you know, like you know, we talk about people like Patrice Lumumba or Thomas Sankara and the Pan-Africanist philosophy on the left, you know, was meant to unite, you know, all these disparate regions because they have this shared history of colonialism. You know, early on, Africa like only had one World Cup spot in the mid 20th century that they could qualify for, and that's because all but three countries were colonized. And so, you know, you only had three countries with national teams, you know, and then later on, as countries became independent, they'd been ravaged by colonialism. Like they weren't given any resources by departing colonial powers. They were still being used in a colonial fashion, especially like France and West Africa is a great example of that. And so that led to, you know, if there were great players from those countries, they would end up having to immigrate due to hardship or go to Europe to play and become a part, you know, like France's national team, you know, Zidane was a good example, you know, like he's an Algerian, but, you know, playing for the French national team. And, you know, the lack of investment in Africa, you know, South Africa hosting the World Cup in 2010 was the first time it had ever been played on the continent. And the African, you know, Federation basically had to essentially boycott the World Cup in order to get more spots. And so eventually, like by the end of the 1980s, they have the five spots that they have today. There's five World Cup qualifying places for Africa. But
Which is still incredibly small because Europe, which is, you know, a smaller continent, has what, like 15,
13 now, I
13?
think, something like that. And then what's interesting about that is, you know, while they base that off of national rank countries' rankings, like each continent, you know, the countries are national teams are all ranked from 1 to 200 something. But like when it comes to that, they're using the rankings to say, okay, Europe gets a third of the spots because they have this many top teams. But all that has a legacy of colonialism and inequality and racism baked into it. Like the you know, you can't look at the world today and not understand it if you, unless you do a material, an historical materialist analysis of it. And so, you know, like Africa, like, and what's happened is like there are parts of Africa that have had more investment than others, especially in the former French colonies, where it's allowed players to develop the, you know, even if they're poor, and you know, make their way into the bigger leagues and play for their own national teams. But the lack of investment also leads to, like, if you don't have strong national domestic clubs and leagues, it leads to, you know, players having to go play in Europe or for MLS or, you know, or in South America or wherever they can play. And it's all of this is a challenging to the development of the national teams there as well as the players. But, you know, certain players have broken through that, like Samuel Eto'o, like the star I mentioned in the last episode, who played alongside Messi, and Suarez are also who factors into the story actually. They all played together. Eto'o's from Cameroon, and they did very well at the World Cup and they, that elevated, you know, Eto'o's like status.
Yeah.
No African team has ever played in the semifinals of the World Cup. However, Ghana should have.
Ghana got very, very close. In the 2010 World Cup, which Jordan mentioned was in South Africa, you know, the first was famous for the Vuvuzelas. And it was a huge moment because, you know, it was the 21st century and the World Cup was coming to Africa for the first time ever. And there were a lot of problems with, you know, the way FIFA ran things in there with, like, you know, sham courts that they set up just for the purpose of the World Cup. But it was a really historic moment. And, you know, in the quarterfinals, the only African team remaining at that point was Ghana. Everyone else had been eliminated, including South Africa, the hosts. So basically, in this game, this quarterfinal game, going into the quarterfinals, they were up against Uruguay. And Uruguay is, you know, a very good, solid team. They're a powerhouse for sure.
Not a big country, but a fairly wealthy one.
Yeah.
Compared to in global terms. Uh-huh. And sandwiched in between Brazil and Argentina.
Yeah.
A lot going for them.
Right. So they're often successful on the international stage. But basically the whole world was cheering for Ghana. And if nothing else, you know, Africa was cheering for Ghana.
And, like, even in the United States, because it's one of those forgettable moments in U.S. men's soccer history, but Ghana had eliminated the United States in the round of 16 to advance to this match.
Yeah.
And, you know, they did it, like, through, like, just outplaying, outworking, outclassing the U.S. In an extra time victory. And so they get in this match with Uruguay, who, you know, like, historically would have been favored just from being, like, a South African, like, you know, it's like from the power region.
Yeah.
From South America, South American power region.
Mm-hmm.
Uruguay, you know, was a strong team, but everyone was rooting for Ghana. Like, you know, even the United States, a lot of people were just pulling for Ghana because, you know, you can't be mad at a team that, like, just wins the way they did.
Yeah.
And, you know, so they had taken Uruguay 1-1 into, like, the late stages of the match.
Yeah, really, really late in the game. I think it was, yeah, like, the 90-something minute. And it was 1-1.
Yeah.
And Ghana had a corner kick. And they whipped it in and sent the ball towards goal. And there was a goal line scramble. And that's one of the most stressful moments in soccer, you know, goal line scrambles. And at this point, we're in extra time. So the way soccer works in the World Cup is if it's a tie, you do two halves of 15-minute halves. So the game ends at 90 minutes, give or take. And if it's still tied, you do two 15-minute halves. And then if it's still tied after that, you go into a penalty shootout. And so in the 120th minute, this goal line scramble happens. And the ball is flying towards the goal. It came off of the head of a Ghanaian forward. And the scramble at the goal line includes none other than Luis Suarez, who, in a moment of desperation, bats the ball away with his hand from the goal line. And you can't do that. That's not allowed in soccer. You cannot touch the ball with your hand on purpose.
Many are saying that handballs are illegal in soccer.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure, a goaltender.
We've been hearing this. So Suarez gets a red card. And as I mentioned in the last episode, anytime there's a foul in the box, let alone a denial of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity, it's a penalty kick. So it's a one-on-one shot with a striker and the keeper. And the success rate of penalty kicks is pretty high. It's not a good situation for the goalie. So the goalie, Muslera, Fernando Muslera, is lined up on the line. And the Ghanaian forward, Asamoah Gyan, lines up to take the kick. And Luis Suarez is supposed to have entered the locker room at this point, but he's standing in the tunnel watching the kick happen. And with the last kick of regular time, or the last kick of extra time, Asamoah Gyan kicks the ball and it hits the crossbar and goes out, and time's called. And Suarez is in the tunnel and he looks up at the crowd and celebrates. And there's a lot of debate about whether what Suarez did was right or wrong. In the laws of the game sense, naturally it was wrong. That's why he got a red card. But some people argue that there's nothing wrong with, you know, strategically receiving a red card for the sake of your team. But regardless of how you feel about that, I have to believe that, celebrating wildly when you're supposed to have already left the pitch because of, a very cheap moment that, cost this very sympathetic team a victory. Because had he not touched it with his hand, it would have been a goal.
Yeah, there's no way they win, like, if he doesn't do that.
Exactly.
And it's a conflict, too, because under the rules of the game, you know, by doing that, instead of it being an automatic goal, even though that's literally what was prevented, was just a clear path between the ball and the goal.
Yeah.
It's a penalty. And like you said, most of the time penalties are converted, but not all the time. Like,
right.
You know, Sergio Aguero has just played his last match in the Premier League. It took like 32 something penalties in his career with Manchester City and only missed five of them.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole point of a penalty kick is to give the striker a pretty sure chance at winning and a slight chance for the goalie to stop it.
So there's like drama there. It's just the reverse of like what you normally feel in soccer, and like is just like it's instead of being a huge deal if a goal is scored, it's just a huge deal if a save is made. Or if in the case of Baggio, 1994, he just misses.
Exactly. But yeah, so Guillen misses, and then they go to a penalty shootout. And he does end up converting his kick in the penalty shootout after, missing one of the most important kicks of his life. But two people later down the lineup missed, and Uruguay ends up winning 4-2 in penalties.
Yeah, this game really is emblematic of, like, the struggle, so to speak, because mentioned, like, Suarez, like, did something that should have absolutely, like, cost his team the match anyway and got away with it. And, by getting a red card, he was out of the semifinals when Uruguay was eliminated. But, so it's just, like, there's a layer of, like, pointlessness to it where it's just, like, something really good was happening that everyone was behind in this historic moment where Ghana would, despite all that the continent has dealt with over the decades and centuries with, like, exploitation and colonialism and everything else, they were about to punch their ticket to the semifinals, and then this happens, and it's just so, it just seems wrong, it feels wrong, like, kind of thing. Like,
absolutely.
It's like, this feels wrong, Bobby.
Yes.
That happened, and I had an interesting experience with this game because I actually heard it on the radio because I was driving from like San Francisco to San Diego, just a little 8-hour drive. And I was in the middle of nowhere, and I was flipping through the radio for anything to listen to, the game's on. I was like, oh, cool, I would have watched this if I had not been in my car in the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. And so I hear it on the radio, and it's just this really surreal experience hearing it just described.
Yeah.
But the way it was described was like, there's just no way that actually happened, right? Like, because I was sure Ghana was going to win when Suarez took the penalty. And the context of this too is that Suarez was kind of the bad boy of the sport at the time. Like, he had biting incidents where he had multiple biting incidents. Just taking a little bite, just have a little bite now of a player's arm. And Suarez like was a bad boy figure in the sport when this happened, and it just only escalated. Just like, again, like the SMH factor,
yeah,
if you will.
And he went on to have a very successful career. Yeah. He played at Barcelona for some time. Is he still at Barcelona?
He was at Barcelona. He was part of that famous front line with Messi and Samuel Eto'o that I alluded to earlier.
Yeah. Oh, he recently transferred to Atletico Madrid. Yeah. But
he had been with Liverpool at the time, and he'd had a biting incident against Chelsea that year.
Yeah. Then he had one at Barcelona.
Yeah.
So this guy, not a good dude. He bites people a lot.
Yeah.
He cheated in this very important moment and,
got away with it.
Yeah. And he still is having a very successful career in the top level of,
Spanish
football.
Asamoah Gyan. For Gyan, it wasn't so good. He went back to Ghana.
Yeah.
They were just like, everyone was mad at him. It was that similar situation that, that Baggio and Andres Escobar faced. Not as extreme as Escobar. He didn't kill for it, but they're just like, he just sort of like lingered in like less prominent leagues while Suarez went on to be a star and one of the biggest clubs in the world.
And Guillen, he still plays in Ghana, and makes a living, but nowhere near the success.
The immortality he would have had in the sport.
Yeah.
And, Africa too, again, speaking about how it's a different region, like, Northern Africa, like Algeria and like Egypt have had their, and Tunisia to an extent have had their share of success in World Cup appearances. Mohamed Salah from Egypt was as a, you know, one of the best players in the Premier League now, a striker for Liverpool, and also a star of the Egyptian team. So I mean, given the talent that is now like being produced and being like developed in Africa, and given the diversity of the, all the different nations involved, like at some point you would hope that like one of them could like, you know, do Ghana proud and maybe break through to the semifinal. Cameroon had a chance when Eto'o was there, you know, Senegal, like, you know, Western Africa, they've been having a lot of success lately. They were kind of the stars of the last World Cup in the sense of the team that everyone was rooting for. So, you know, we'll see what happens, but just soccer, football, if you will, very, very much reflects like the world and very much reflects the material and like social, racial inequalities that exist.
Yeah. One final event from history that we want to touch on is, and I guess this does also extend into the present as well, but it's from a region that I'm very interested in a topic I'm very interested in, and that's the, you know, troubles in Ireland. There is a very famous soccer rivalry in Glasgow, Scotland, called the Old Firm. And essentially what it is there's these two clubs, Celtic FC and Rangers. And Celtic and the Rangers are very deeply opposed to one another, for sporting reasons and for political and sectarian reasons. Basically, for a little context, the north of Ireland has long been colonized by settlers from England and largely Scotland. And throughout the years, that sort of colonization was very deeply institutionalized along sectarian lines, where Protestants in the north enjoyed a great deal more rights than Catholics in the north. And the Protestants almost entirely descended from, you know, Scottish and to a lesser extent English settlers, and the Catholics were, you know, native Irish. And so that's a long time conflict that's still going on today. You know, the north of Ireland is still occupied by the UK, which is a reason why Irish people are in such stark solidarity with Palestine, because they experience it themselves. But in Glasgow, Scotland, there is a large contingency of, you know, an Irish immigrant community and descendants of an Irish immigrant community. So Glasgow, despite being in Scotland, naturally houses this community of immigrants from a nation that they have to an extent colonized. And the Celtic Rangers match is, you know, a very big manifestation of that. The matches are wild. The Celtic fans fly Irish flags, you know, sing Republican IRA songs, and it's just a wild moment. Celtic recently made the news because after Prince Philip died, there was a moment of silence, and Celtic fans stood outside the stadium and launched fireworks during the
extremely loud celebratory fireworks.
Yeah, and some people were saying, you know, how do you even know this is Celtic fans? You know, it could have been somebody else. And then a Celtic fan page posted a picture of them them lighting the fireworks off, and it said, "Don't let the crown get you down." So, cool moment.
How can you not like that?
Yeah.
Unless you're just a weirdo monarchist.
Yeah. If you're a leftist of any kind, look into Celtic FC. There's some cool stuff happening. But the Irish troubles issue gets a little more intense on the national scale when you look at the, you know, 1994 World Cup and the Lowen Island pub massacre.
Sorry, before we get to that downer of a story, I just remember just how absurd it was that the moment of silence was for Prince Philip.
Yeah, this 90 plus year old man.
Yeah, who's like, just like this. I'll go off on the monarch. I'll go off on this topic on another episode. I just thought about how before we get into more of the sadness, I just wanted to
Yeah, the death wasn't exactly like a shocker. The men had been on the edge of death for years at that point. But yeah, you know, with the, you know, shitting on the UK, as you always should, there was this issue that happened where, you know, like I said, the UK was occupying Ireland and still are, and violence had been going on for decades all throughout the 20th century. During halftime of this match, where was this match happening?
New Jersey.
Yeah.
This is interesting because, you know, you could think of Rangers and Celtic, for example, as a, as like the Celtics and Knicks in the NBA, except like 1,000 times more extreme.
Yeah.
Where in like the Knicks being orange, the Celtics being green and being called the Celtics, and being like, have this like Irish identity, which gets into the fact that there is a lot of Irish people in the United States. There are also a lot of Italians in New York specifically, and in, you know, and in Boston to a degree. Like, it's where like these diasporas are most concentrated in the United States.
Felix Biederman once referred to Ireland as Wakanda Boston.
Oh yeah. definitely it's almost to the point where it's like, you know, there's certain diasporas in the United States. For a while, like, the United States was home to the largest Jewish population in the world. I think that's tilted to Israel now. I'm not sure. But I know, like, New York City specifically was. And then, like, you know, a lot of Irish people, just like they had to flee to Boston or England during the famine and occupation by England, had also migrated to the United States, including, you know, like, some of my distant relatives. And so anyway, and then Armenia, there's a large Armenian diaspora in Glendale, California, in like Los Angeles area, which is interesting, the largest outside of Armenia itself. So anyway, whenever you have these pockets, these enclaves of like intense diaspora populations in the United States, if a World Cup match happens in 1994, hosting the World Cup, it was a hot ticket. Like, and what happened is, like, you know, while each side kind of had their allotment, most of the Italians bought tickets and just sold them to the Irish and went and spent the money on something else. And so it ended up being basically a home match for Ireland.
Yeah.
Ireland is, like, not always good at football. Let's just say, like, you know, they have other sports, like, you know, like Bennett's familiar with, like, hurling and, like, Irish football, right?
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah,
different, you know. But they also, soccer is still popular there, but they're never, it's a small country and it's, like, the never really dominant. So this was a high point for Ireland because they were in the World Cup and were playing Italy. You know, currently Ireland's in a World Cup qualification right now and just somehow lost to Luxembourg. So
yeah.
I'm not sure how good their chances are of getting to the World Cup
because
Luxembourg is a very small country that should have no business beating Ireland.
Right. Ireland's success is very widely variant in terms of association football, which association football is the long name for soccer. It's where the word soccer comes from, so both soccer and football are totally fine to say. But Ireland tends to excel at other sports like hurling and Gaelic football, and, you know, rugby they do pretty well. But association football, it's kind of touch and go. They are very successful some years and then very much not.
Given that context, so this is as big for, you know, Ireland being at the stage is as big as the United States being in the World Cup at this point in terms of, like, historical success. And so, you know, the match ends up going very well for Ireland.
Yes.
They, like, you know, take the lead early and... Oh, yeah. So, anyway. So, this is the biggest match in Ireland's history. And to get to the World Cup, it's interesting to point out that they had to play their final qualifier match against Northern Ireland in Belfast.
Yeah.
So given that that was the case, they had to, you know, they traveled there under extremely armed guard because this was still towards the tail end of the Troubles where they're just beginning to try to work out a peace process between the IRA and the UVC and the sectarian elements that have been, like, you know, really fighting in Northern Ireland. You know, the Unionists versus the Republicans, the Irish Republicans. And so, you know, that match happens and it's a, you know, huge crowd is chanting Northern Ireland, chanting all the stuff that you hear Rangers fans chant in Glasgow, just horrible, like, things about Irish people, and then vice versa. You know, you might hear from Celtic fans and, like, you know, one of their hooligan chants is Ratarnese and Fenian blood, and they'll talk about like just horrible stuff like that. You know, so the rhetoric around the rivalry is just like between Northern Ireland and Ireland, between the Republicans and the Unionists, between Protestants and Catholics, is very sharply drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Ireland ended up getting the draw that they needed to advance to the World Cup.
Yeah,
and, you know, it was a 1-1 draw. So you know, their path had gone through Northern Ireland, and it was a very just like kind of poetic thing, I think, to happen.
Yeah.
But at the World Cup, they score against Italy and hold on to win 1-0.
Yeah, which is huge. That's a bit of an upset for sure.
Italy's a traditional powerhouse, just like they won the great domestic leagues, some of the greatest players of all time. They end up recovering from this and going on, you know, to the final against Brazil. But this is, you know, an early shock that things maybe were not going to go entirely well for them in the tournament because...
Yeah.
You know, this is a major, major moment, and you know, it's a huge celebration for everyone in Ireland. But at halftime of the match,
unfortunately, there was a moment of violence from the UVF, which is the Ulster Volunteer Force. It's basically like a terrorist organization that's often conflated as like a sort of equivalent to the IRA.
Oh shit, what did I call them earlier?
UBC or something like that. Oh, I think that's also a thing.
Yeah.
But the UVF, it's...
UVC.
Yeah. The UVF is very much like a pro-unionist thing. And I think there is a bit of a difference. You know, they often committed somewhat comparable attacks to one another in terms of, you know, like moral authority of like civilians getting impacted. But I will say this one was particularly egregious. This was in the 90s where violence had been starting to wane to an extent and it was becoming less and less popular among either section, Protestant or Catholic, to commit violence like this. But basically two UVF members entered this largely Catholic bar and just opened fire with assault rifles, and six people died. And it was a really, really brutal moment of violence, one of the worst that had been seen in a while in Ireland.
Just like extra senseless.
Yeah.
And you know, there had been like some tensions because the U.S. had invited over a politician that, you know, they claimed had IRA ties or had been, you know, an Irish Republican. And, like, you know, so, you know, that's one thing. But to go into a bar in like a small town and like shoot six people at halftime during, you know, like, you know, it's in Northern Ireland. I'm sure if you're like an Irish Catholic in Northern Ireland, you like want Ireland to win.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. So, yeah, very, very awful moment.
Just interesting, like how that World Cup like dovetailed with so many like things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, that wasn't the worst thing that happened, like, to, you know, during that World Cup or in the aftermath, because in Colombia, you know, we had the situation we talked about in the last episode where they were all worried the families were going to get killed,
right,
during the match, and just couldn't concentrate, and like, you know, Escobar gets killed when he goes home, and it's just the gravity of like politics and football. Like, nothing touches the World Cup.
Yeah.
Like, you get all these, you know, almost every country on earth participates, from Mexico to like Kenya to North Korea. Like, you know, not all of them qualify, but
you always have qualifiers, at least a couple from every single continent.
Exactly. Like FIFA membership is includes most of the world, and you will get at least four or five teams from every major continent.
Yeah, and you know, talking about the World Cup, it's probably the last thing we touch on as we're approaching an hour on this third part, which is amazing. And you know, like I said, we really could have a whole.
We're really good at this.
Yeah, we're very top notch podcasters. Yeah, exactly. Please feel free to send us money.
Austin's top podcasters.
Oh yes,
for sure.
But we really could do a whole series about this. There's just so much to talk about. But some current events that bear discussing are: there's a World Cup coming up a year from now. Probably less than at this point. No? Yes.
Late 2022.
Okay,
so
yeah.
A little over a year.
Yeah, a little over a year from now. In
a year and a half.
Yeah, late 2022. I think in November 2022 to December. A World Cup is being hosted in Qatar, weirdly enough. You know, what business does Qatar have hosting a World Cup?
Business, you say?
Yeah, business. Beats me because it's humid as hell. The World Cup usually happens in summer. They're tiny and mostly desert.
Yeah, no. Qatar is home to 313,000 Qatari citizens and 2.3 million expatriates. It's
Yes.
one of those like Middle Eastern kind of smaller countries, kind of like UAE is like a confederation of like different emirates where like Abu Dhabi and Dubai and other places. You have Bahrain, you have Qatar, Kuwait, all kind of tucked in there around the Persian Gulf next to Saudi Arabia. Interestingly about Qatar too is they've been caught up in that proxy war lately between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Saudi Arabia essentially accused Qatar of aligning with Iran against their interest and closed the border with Qatar. And the only land border Qatar has is with Saudi Arabia. And try to get OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, which is most of the Middle East, to cut them out, and they got the UAE to also boycott the country essentially. And this is all happening after Qatar had won the World Cup bid. How Qatar won the World Cup bid is very interesting. It's pretty clear that the Sepp Blatter era of FIFA, the man we know and love, he was riddled with corruption. U.S. Justice Department, I think, actually ended up bringing down certain high-level FIFA officials with an investigation. Some in other parts of the world argued that the U.S. was bitter for losing out on the World Cup to Qatar. But when you think about it, like, there's no reason why. And I'm not like some kind of rah-rah flag-waving guy, but country-to-country comparison: United States stadiums already built, has hosted a World Cup successfully. Qatar. No stadiums that could host the World Cup. They all have to be built. Very small. Extremely hot in the summer with temperatures either nearing 120 degrees or oppressive humidity that can send the heat index shooting into like the 130, 140 range.
Also, again, you know our politics. We're not, USA stans. We know that the situation for workers and the labor movement is tough in the US, but it pales in comparison to the situation in Qatar, where literal slavery is happening.
Yeah, this is like, there's been talk about this in Dubai with like the construction boom there and the global capital is pouring money into the city. But, people are brought in from often from South Asia or Southeast Asia with a promise of you'll make good money, you can send it home to your family, it's like it'll be fun, it's a nice place to live, etc. And then they're brought over, their passports are confiscated, they're given substandard housing, they're told they have to work off the cost of their trip over, which is inflated. And so this is common practice in both the UAE and Qatar and Bahrain and other countries over there. And there's very much a racist like caste system in it too, because all these expatriates are from, and some are from the Philippines and other places too in like the Southeast Asian region, South Asia region. So they're brought over, and so of course it's pretty commonly even in the US media, which tends to like gloss over human quote unquote human rights abuses in countries that we're favorable towards. We're talking about this, and these stadiums are not going to be built like with any sort of ethical process,
Absolutely
and
not.
that's happened. Reports say that at least 2,000 workers have died building the stadiums. They're working long hours under terrible living conditions in extremely hot weather. And there's no guarantee even that their stadiums are all going to be built in time. And like there's just a lot of like there's a lot of questions around this World Cup. But there's also a lot of questions about how they got it in the first place, because the way Sepp Blatter had like maintained his FIFA presidency despite controversies is every FIFA member, no matter how large or small, gets one vote. And the representative, so Sepp Blatter had sort of gone around and like made sure to like address like those smaller countries and carry favor with them, so that when it came down to it, he was reinstated as FIFA president. Meanwhile, the vote to install Qatar as the World Cup host in 2022 has been openly corrupt. There's been a lot of payments that have been made. A lot of this has been covered extensively in media, but there were a lot of large payments made to voting members of FIFA that had the choice to do this. So not only were they making a choice that even FIFA itself has said is very high risk, they identified Qatar as a high risk host. But they did this, you know, like essentially for their own gain. And while there have been some arrests, and Blatter's no longer the president of FIFA, there's been some house cleaning, but you know, this is just what we could see, you know. And we talked earlier about how FIFA has always been aligned with nefarious and bad actors when necessary.
Yeah. And despite the arrests, like, the World Cup is still going forward in Qatar.
Yeah.
And they've, even to address the heat in summer issue, decided to move it to November and December, which is not when the World Cup is traditionally held. And it's smack dab in the middle of basically every major league's, you know, regular season. So it's just going to be a nightmare of... It already has been a nightmare for, you know, thousands upon thousands of workers. And, you know, it's going to be a nightmare in terms of quality of play, in terms of, you know, a viewing experience. Yeah. And
I mean, even to put it like, in, you know, in terms for the U.S., like Christian Pulisic is like, you know, star player for Chelsea now, the star of the U.S. national team.
Mm-hmm.
Like Chelsea is going to be playing, you know, in the English Premier League when the World Cup happens. Like, unless they're able to convince all these major domestic leagues to rearrange their schedules around the World Cup, which the thing is, they're already arranged around the World Cup. Like, international tournaments happen in the summer for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's because the domestic leagues, you know, are shut down for the off season, and players can just go and do their thing for their national teams.
Exactly. And there's talk of, you know, some players boycotting it. Viewers certainly boycotting it. I mean, I'm a huge soccer fan. I love to watch the World Cup. I don't intend on watching the 2022 World Cup. I might, like, you know, pirate highlights or something, but it, I mean, it's just tainted. How can I watch, you know, a World Cup happening in this country that is just completely inhospitable to soccer, one, and then two, just openly built upon slave labor.
And, like, even if you're talking in strictly financial terms, like, for ratings, like, it's east of Europe by a couple time zones, but when you're talking about ratings in the Western Hemisphere, North and South America, it's going to be on in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
It's, like, the matches are going to be on at, like, 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
And, like, it's just, like, everything about this is just completely just, like, off the wall, like, insane.
Yeah, not good. And, you know, I guess we're going to see what happens. We're going to see if it goes forward, you know, where the COVID situation's at and where, you know, if they can get enough teams to play and whatnot. But, yeah, soccer's in a really weird spot right now, and it's at a turning point, you could say. And there's a lot of, you know, interest in the corruption and interest in maybe boycotting Qatar and kind of examining the political intersections of sport and politics and money. But... you know, this is one of those organizations that's pretty, you know, untouchable, just in terms of being the organization with all the money and all the power to regulate the most popular sport in the world.
Arguably more powerful and untouchable than the International Olympic Committee, because instead of dealing with governments, they're dealing just with, like, leagues with primarily private, you know, private leagues, private owned teams.
Exactly.
And private associations like UEFA and CONCACAF and others.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a wild, wild situation. This is probably a good spot to wrap it up. We're over an hour now. There were a few things we didn't quite get to that we can discuss more, maybe in some, fiery social media threads. but I think we managed to cram in a lot to 3 episodes, and I hope this is made for, you know, an enjoyable, compelling listen for Marxists and leftists and soccer fans alike.
Even liberals.
Yeah, liberals, you know, if you're listening.
Left.
Yeah, please. Join DSA, do some. But yeah, this has been great to chat. And I mean, I've learned a lot through this, and I hope you, the listeners, have as well. Yes, anyhow, this has been Ben and Jordan in podcast, and thanks for listening.